Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of All Crime, No Cattle. I'm Erin.
And I am Shay.
And we are freshly back from Chicago from the True Crime Podcast Festival. We had an absolutely fantastic time. We met so many fellow podcasters, a lot of whom are people that we've talked to online or that we're fans of ourselves. And so that was really exciting. And we met a lot of you, too. A lot of listeners came, and it was an absolute blast.
So many listeners. It was so wonderful to meet you guys in person, and you guys brought us gifts. Do we want to mention some of the gifts that they brought us?
Yeah, thank you so much to Lori and Elijah. They gave me a Texas necklace, and they gave Shay a very ridiculous Texas keychain.
I love it. It's amazing. It's so over the top. It's got these little Texas bedangle things on there. I like it.
Yeah. And to Allison, who gave us this really cool embroidery she made that's a cow with one of those circles with the lines through it. So no cattle.
Yeah. And it's so cool. Like, we're going to have to frame it and put it somewhere in our podcasting room.
Yeah. But it was a really great time. I know a lot of people couldn't come this year, but remember, we're all planning to do it all again next year. So we'll let you know when that happens.
That's right. It should be a really cool destination every year from here on out. We're hoping to keep it going. Well, we've left the Windy City, but we haven't left the true crime genre. We're ready to start a new episode for All Crime, No Cattle for you guys. Well, last week we covered a case from Houston, but this week we are going to head right back to the H-Town area to discuss a case full of forensics, facts, lies, and some major questions that still remain long after the public received a conclusion. So with no further ado, let's get right into it as I bring you episode 56, Houston Double Homicide. Sources for this episode include glad.org, and that was an article written by Alexandra Bowles back in April of 2014. We used LGBTQ Nation, and that was an uncredited article from March of 2014. I used the Houston Press, and this is going to be our first 2016 article. There's a collection of them. This one was written by Diana Ray. We used the Houston Chronicle article from Harvey Rice, the Patch article by Alex Wookman, a Fox 26 Houston article by Caitlin Monty, and the Galveston County Daily News by Shakur Koop. One of our final sources is the True Crime Daily, which is an article written by Andrea Issam. This one kind of partners with the True Crime Daily News series on TV with Chris Hansen. And lastly, we used After Ellen. This is an article from Emily Magogny from January of 2017. So this week's story starts back in March of 2014. That month, the weather in Houston, Texas was beautiful. It was that time of the season where we get a few short weeks of spring before heading straight into the bowels of summer that us Texans know all too well. Brittany Cosby and Crystal Jackson were two Houston residents that were enjoying these notoriously short spring weeks along the Texas coast that year. Both were 24 years old, determined to make a better life for themselves, and they were also deeply in love. The two had begun dating some 2 years previously and also began raising Crystal's 5-year-old daughter, Zanaya. Crystal and Brittany, though from the same area of town, were raised under very different circumstances. Crystal, for instance, came from a good home and a strong religious background. Her father, Ivan Jackson, was a reverend at their local church. Ivan and Crystal's mother, Mary, told Crime Watch Daily that Crystal and Brittany were certainly in love. Quote, they were two peas in a pod. So I think you get the feeling from watching their interviews on Crime Watch Daily how supportive that Ivan and Mary were of Crystal and Brittany's relationship. Things were a little different for Brittany, though. Early in her life, her parents, LaRonda McDonald and James Cosby, they separated. That meant that the responsibility of raising Brittany eventually fell on Annie Lee Cosby, her 90-year-old great-grandmother. Annie Lee appeared to have done her best to raise her great-grandchild. As Brittany and Crystal began dating, at some point, Crystal and Zanaya moved in at that Houston home with Brittany and her great-grandmother, Annie Lee. Both Crystal and Brittany worked and had been saving up money while they lived with Annie Lee. Recently, however, Brittany's father, James Cosby, had moved into the home as well. This sort of changed the dynamic in the household, because Brittany didn't have a great relationship with her father, who had mostly been absent from her life from an early age.
Okay, so Crystal, her daughter Zaniah, have moved into Brittany's house where she's living with her great-grandmother Annie Lee, and now Brittany's father has kind of joined the household, and we can assume maybe, you know, some kind of hard feelings or something on Brittany's behalf, considering, you know, this was kind of an absentee father. Is that kind of the situation we're looking at?
And also, like you can imagine, it's probably a little weird if for a couple of years you've been taking care of your great-grandmother, she's been raising you, you've had this kind of dynamic going on, and then all of a sudden James comes back into the picture. That kind of mixes things up.
Okay.
Well, Brittany and Crystal had spent the better part of the previous 2 years helping to take care of Brittany's great-grandmother. They would go on grocery runs, keep the house clean, and make sure all of Annie Lee's bills were paid. Once James moved back into the home, Crystal and Brittany almost immediately started making plans to find their own place. They had recently bought a car. It was a used 2006 Kia Sorento SUV. They planned to share this vehicle with each other and use it to kind of ferry Zaniah back and forth to school, as well as continue looking for a new place to live and do their apartment shopping. It was also nice because Annie Lee showed her appreciation for Crystal and Brittany's help by co-signing on the loan. Crystal and Brittany were proud of this purchase. They brought their new car over to show Crystal's parents, Ivan and Mary Jackson, on the evening of March 6th. The two women had a short visit, picked up Crystal's daughter, Zaniah, and drove back home. As they left, they told Ivan and Mary that they loved them. This would be the final time Ivan and Mary Jackson would see Crystal and Brittany alive. The following day, Mary became very concerned when Zaniah didn't show up for school. You see, Crystal's mother Mary worked at Zaniah's school and would always be sure to check on Zaniah at some point throughout the day. Mary called Crystal and Brittany's phone several times, but those calls only went to voicemail. This was definitely out of the ordinary behavior for Crystal and Brittany, who had a very close relationship with both the Jacksons. They were typically really good at staying in contact.
Okay, yeah, I can see that being really worrisome if you are working at a school and are used to seeing your granddaughter around, and one day she doesn't show up, and then your daughter and her partner aren't answering their phones.
Exactly. And so the following day, Ivan and Mary decided to run by Crystal and Brittany's house to see what was going on. Brittany and Crystal weren't home, however, but Annie Lee and James Cosby were home with Zaniah. Neither Annie Lee or James had seen Crystal or Brittany since the previous morning. According to Annie Lee and James, Crystal and Brittany left early that morning, but for some reason left young Zaniah at home alone. When Annie Lee and James got home that afternoon, they found Zaniah, but there was no sign of Crystal, Brittany, or the new Kia Sorento. They seemed to be just as clueless as Crystal's parents, Ivan and Mary, as to where Crystal and Brittany went.
So by the time Ivan and Mary got there, Crystal and Brittany had been kind of missing for like 24 hours.
Yeah. James and Annie Lee kind of thought that they were going to show up at some point, but they hadn't.
Okay.
So the question started to develop, where were Crystal and Brittany? Why hadn't they told someone that they planned to leave so suddenly? Why wouldn't they have left Crystal's daughter, Zaniah, with Crystal's parents? Like we said earlier, her parents were the ones who often looked after the child after school and on the weekends. Crystal's mother, Mary, took the initiative and started calling local police departments, jails, and finally resorted to checking the local morgue. Everywhere she looked, nothing seemed to turn up regarding their whereabouts, which Mary took as a good sign initially. At this point, Mary was holding out hope that Crystal and Brittany would eventually turn up. But after 48 hours and no new information, she decided it was finally time to file a missing persons report. Once the authorities became involved, they interviewed some of Brittany and Crystal's local friends and family. Brittany's great-grandmother, Annie Lee, remembered that Crystal and Brittany had joked in the past about going down to Galveston for a short vacation. Another family member told KTRTV News that Crystal and Brittany had mentioned going down to Galveston for Mardi Gras. Could they have simply run off in secret to the coast? It didn't seem likely. And as the search for Crystal and Brittany began to get started in Houston, a grisly discovery was about to be made down in Port Bolivar, Texas. That's about an hour southeast of Houston. Port Bolivar, Texas is situated on a peninsula in Galveston Bay. It's just to the northeast of Galveston Island itself. Port Bolivar is sort of the forgotten sister to the Galveston, Texas resort area. In its prime, Galveston was one of the largest ports in the United States and a thriving tourist attraction. That was until it was devastated by the unexpected Galveston hurricane in the year 1900. The damage from the storm was tremendous, and still ranks as one of the deadliest storms in U.S. history. An estimated 6,000 to 12,000 people died during the Great Storm of 1900. According to the Galveston County Daily News, the same weekend of Brittany and Crystal's disappearance, a beer delivery driver was dropping off a shipment at a local convenience store down in Port Bolivar, Texas. After his delivery was done, he walked around the side of the store to throw away some of his spare boxes into a dumpster. Next to the dumpster, he saw what he assumed to be two discarded mannequins. He returned inside to the clerk and asked about them. The clerk then went to investigate and realized that these weren't mannequins at all, but the dead bodies of two young women. William Kilbourne, a former forensic investigator for the Galveston County Sheriff's Office, was there that day and told Crime Watch Daily, quote, "The bodies were found intertwined and strewn like rag dolls." Even veteran investigators were stunned at the sheer brutality, end quote. When the authorities arrived, they began processing the scene near the dumpster between the convenience store and the old boarded-up hotel next door. One of the women was found on her back. Her eyes were open, and the cause of death was immediately obvious. She had a single gunshot wound to the head, which looked to be from a large-caliber weapon. Next to her lay the body of a second woman. She was face down on the ground. Her head had been wrapped in a bloody sheet. When the sheet was removed by investigators, they discovered the extent of this woman's injuries. She had been struck in the head multiple times with a blunt object. Parts of her skull were crushed inward as a result. Near the bodies were two boards and another piece of wood, which had been part of a set of false shutters, probably from a home's exterior. All three of these pieces of wood had blood spatter on them, and on the false shutter, investigators found a single partial fingerprint in blood. Detectives theorized that these two boards and the false shutter may have been used to move the bodies to this site. Another piece of evidence found at the scene was a blood-covered envelope addressed to one Brittany Cosby. It started to look like Galveston authorities had stumbled on the bodies of the two missing Houston women.
And I'm assuming they believe that this bloody fingerprint came from the killer or killers.
That's correct.
And so both of these bodies, there were clearly two weapons used. You said that there was one of the women was killed with a gun, and the other one, there was some sort of blunt force trauma to the head.
Right. Immediately, investigators were thinking that they had two different murder weapons and at least one to two killers.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, overall, the scene didn't have much blood to speak of. Considering the two women's wounds, one would have expected large blood pooling near the bodies. Detectives deduced that this was a dump site, and the actual murders took place somewhere else. Port Bolivar authorities quickly contacted Houston PD and began trying to pin down the identity of both victims. Houston PD knew of two missing women that fit the description of the bodies. The worst-case scenario seemed to be coming true. When the news reached Brittany and Crystal's families, they were obviously distraught and confused as to how this could have even happened. Brittany's father, James, was said to be, quote, inconsolable and an absolute wreck by detectives. And Ivan and Mary Jackson didn't fare much better. Even though they were overcome with grief, both families assisted in the gruesome task of IDing the bodies. Just a few hours later, the surrounding community quickly banded together and began plans for a candlelight vigil for Crystal and Brittany. While detectives and forensic technicians were busy processing and analyzing the evidence from the crime scene, another clue was discovered, this time near Brittany and Crystal's home in Houston. On a large dirt road near their house, a Good Samaritan was walking his dog when he found a discarded wallet. The ID inside belonged to Brittany Cosby. Investigators searched the area where the wallet was found and determined it may have been a possible initial dump site for the women's bodies before they were eventually moved down to Port Bolivar. More importantly, this meant that the two women were likely killed in or around their Houston home.
So what made them think it was an initial dump site? Was there blood? Was there some kind of scuffs on the ground that made it look like there was an altercation there?
Good question. They did find tire marks from the Kia Sorento that showed that it moved in, backed up, and then moved in and out again at a different time period. Also, they found some blood and they found some footprints.
So now we're looking at the fact that their bodies might have been moved with their own car.
Yes.
Wow.
The timeline of Brittany and Crystal's disappearance, as well as a few small details, still confused detectives that were working on the case. 2 days after the discovery of their bodies, detectives returned to the residence of Annie Lee Cosby to ask Brittany's father, James, a few more questions regarding the morning of Crystal and Brittany's disappearance. Detectives asked James if he knew any reason why Crystal and Brittany would have left Zaniah alone by herself and not at least taken her to school that morning or to the home of Crystal's parents, Ivan and Mary. James told detectives it was strange, but, quote, it was the same time they usually left in the morning. It was like a normal morning. Nothing was out of the ordinary, end quote.
So is he basically admitting that he was the last one to see them alive and that he saw them leave that morning?
Pretty much. And this is kind of the first time detectives have picked up a little extra information from him, and things really aren't kind of matching up with his story anymore. Because at first, he was coming home and finding Zaniah there that afternoon, left alone, and now he's seen them leave in the morning. And he has a little bit more to say, but he also doesn't have any extra details.
Yeah, that's pretty suspicious.
Yeah. So detectives have kind of like put a pin in their hat with James, and they're trying to see if James might have something to do with this case. But they're also trying to track down other loose ends at the same time. They still need to find the murder weapons, the scene of the actual murders, and the women's missing Kia Sorento. While trying to track down the missing SUV, detectives discovered the exact vehicle on surveillance video from a few different locations from around town. Annie Lee and James said the two women left early that morning, and around that same time, surveillance video from a nearby liquor store that was closed showed the vehicle pulling into the parking lot and then leaving. Later that evening, the same vehicle passes by yet again. So investigators think that this might be the Kia Sorento going one way towards that dirt road that we talked about that might have been the initial dump site. And then when it goes back by, that might be it headed south towards Galveston and Port Bolivar.
After maybe this person picked up the bodies again.
And... right.
Okay.
More sightings of the gray Kia Sorento were also found on security cameras at the Galveston Ferry Landing. The Galveston Ferry Landing is a ferry that also runs over to Port Bolivar. And just like you were theorizing earlier, Aaron, this footage shows that Brittany and Crystal weren't driving the vehicle. On the video, their vehicle pulled up to a security checkpoint at the ferry landing. The posted guard approached the vehicle to alert the driver that one of their headlights was out. The guard spoke with the driver for a few short moments, and then the driver got out of the SUV, walked around to the front of the vehicle, and checked the faulty headlight for himself. I say himself because the driver appears on surveillance footage as a tall African-American man. The man then gets back into the SUV, and the security guard allows him to continue on to the ferry. Detectives spoke with the security guard, who was able to provide a composite sketch and a description of the man, which was later released to the public. That public police release reads, quote, "The suspect is a black man in his late 20s or early 30s, 5'11" to 6 feet tall, with an average build, a slight mustache, and a small soul patch of a beard." 2 days after the discovery of Brittany and Crystal's bodies, a full autopsy report returned to the Galveston County Sheriff's Office. First, the autopsy showed that the murder of Brittany and Crystal likely occurred between 9 p.m. Thursday and 7:45 a.m. Friday morning. It also showed that the blunt force trauma to Brittany's skull was complete overkill. Likely the first hit to the side of Brittany's skull not only crushed bone inward into her brain, but also delivered enough force that it snapped her head back fast enough to break her neck and sever her spinal cord. This blow also fractured her coronal suture all the way from the point of impact to the opposite side of her skull. So, Aaron, do you want to describe what the coronal suture is for our listeners?
Yeah, the coronal suture is the suture that goes around the frontal bone, so you have your forehead, and then behind it on the top and sides of your head are your parietal bones. And so the coronal suture is the suture that's going across that frontal in between the parietal and the frontal. The reason why it's called the coronal suture, it's meant to be like a crown. It's really more like a tiara, how you would wear a tiara. Yeah. That's basically where that coronal suture is. So what that suggests is she was hit on the side of the head, maybe on the where that frontal bone is, or maybe where the temporal is, which is kind of in the middle head part. And that force carried its way through that suture, which is, I mean, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, you can imagine how much force it would take to break the whole coronal suture open.
Yeah.
Well, even though this blow was likely fatal, she received multiple more strikes to her face, head, and neck area.
Ugh.
So you have this terrible beating of Brittany, and the killer wrapped her head in a bed sheet. Possibly this was done to contain what was left of her skull while the killer transported the body to the dump site in Port Bolivar. But why else do you think the killer may have wrapped Brittany's head in a sheet?
Well, I feel like this is criminology 101. I think anybody listening to this has the same idea. It looks like Brittany was killed by somebody close to her, somebody who knew her. There was a lot of rage in that murder. If that's the case, covering her face would be a sign of remorse or guilt or whatever from the killer. Especially if you compare that to how Crystal was killed, where it was just a single gunshot to the head, almost as if she was an afterthought.
Yeah, and it kind of indicates that the killer is probably directly connected to Brittany.
Yeah, exactly.
And with regards to Crystal and her wounds, the gunshot wound to Crystal's head was likely from close range. The entry and exit wounds matched that of a large caliber pistol. The autopsy revealed an interesting detail, though. Crystal had bruising around her neck and throat area as if someone had attempted to strangle her with a solid cord, perhaps something like a synthetic cable or a power cord to an electrical device.
Oh, wow. And do we know, with the gunshot, do we know where it actually entered her head?
The entry wound was from the front in the kind of forehead area, and the exit wound was in the rear of the skull.
So whoever did this basically looked her in the eyes as they shot her.
Yeah, and I think both victims didn't show any signs of defensive wounds either, and fingernail scrapings were taken from both women, and they showed no signs of significant DNA samples. For those reasons, detectives think the killings probably happened quickly. Brittany and Crystal likely didn't have much time to react.
Yeah.
The autopsy also made it clear that both bodies were missing large amounts of blood. This validated investigators' theories that the blood absent from the dump site in Port Bolivar, as well as the two women's bodies, had to be somewhere. Most likely, it would be at the kill site. As the autopsy report and the composite police sketch hit local and state news, the story snowballed to a national level. LGBTQ news outlets like GLAAD, After Ellen, Elixir.com, and LGBTQ Nation quickly picked up this story. Their coverage focused on the discussion of whether this case was a hate crime on lesbian women or a brutal double homicide for other reasons. And I have to say, from reading a ton of different reports on this case, these LGBTQ news outlets had the most factual coverage as far as the case details are concerned. In fact, I read several other articles that weren't from LGBTQ news sources, and they confused and mixed things up all over the place, like the identities of Crystal and Brittany compared to some of the wounds that they sustained. They mixed up their parents. It was almost as if that the LGBTQ news sources had a vested interest in this case and were really trying to be as accurate as possible.
Yeah, I think that says a lot about how certain people are treated by mainstream media versus sort of special interest news sources or media sources. And that's a really big problem where these cases need to be focused on in regular media. The special interest groups shouldn't be the only ones paying attention to these kinds of stories.
And I think that's key. And as some of these LGBTQ plus media sources really started to push Crystal and Brittany's story into the national spotlight, the next big clue in the case dropped. Remember that partial fingerprint in blood on the false shutter that I mentioned earlier? Well, the results were finally in. After running this partial print through a series of forensic analyses, algorithms, and possible criminal databases, forensic technicians were able to obtain a positive match to this print with a percent error of 0.001. The fingerprint came back as a match to the seemingly grieving and inconsolable father of Brittany Cosby, none other than James Cosby. 6 days after the murders of Brittany and Crystal, authorities had their first main suspect. With a fresh warrant, a large team of forensic technicians, and some perfect timing, detectives returned to the home of Brittany and Crystal one last time. James Cosby wasn't at home at this point. He was actually attending a large candlelight vigil that afternoon and evening for Crystal and Brittany. As James made a tearful speech to the media and shook hands with supporters at the vigil, Galveston detectives were busy uncovering the final pieces to this gruesome mystery. Outside, under a carport where Brittany and Crystal's Kia Sorento would have likely been parked, there were numerous spots of blood that were detected with luminol. On the side of the home, one of the detectives quickly noticed a missing false shutter that matched the one that was found at the crime scene. What they found next inside the home was shocking. Investigator William Culburn told Crime Watch Daily, quote, "Everywhere we were looking, we were finding something with blood on it. Tiny drops, bigger drops, pools, swipes. They were on the door, in the carpet, in the couch, and on clothes," end quote. When forensic technicians treated James Cosby's bedroom with luminol to find further signs of blood evidence, they said, quote, "the room lit up." Detectives documented indications that someone had tried to clean up large areas of blood in that room with household cleaners, which we all know usually doesn't work, and in the end, you just leave behind blood residue and evidence that someone tried to clean up blood. Some of the large pools of blood soaked through the carpet and into the floorboards. It appeared to investigators that someone tried to hide those larger stains with small area rugs that they had just laid around the room. Near one of the blood-stained areas, investigators located a disconnected yellow electrical cord with blood on it. Detectives now believed this was the cord used to unsuccessfully strangle Crystal Jackson before she was shot. Beyond the substantial amount of blood evidence at the scene, investigators also found a box that contained a mixture of ammunition for both .357 and .38 caliber handguns. James Cosby owned a .357 caliber pistol, but it was missing from the home. The sheer amount of evidence collected at the scene was staggering. Investigator Kilbourne commented, quote, "This is the most evidence I've collected on a crime scene. 307 individual pieces, and 209 of them said it was James Cosby that committed the crime." By the end of the search, detectives had begun to build a loose timeline and theory of what happened that night. They theorized the murders happened very early that morning. James most likely got into a fight with Brittany, savagely beat her to death, and then perhaps Crystal walked into the room. James then attempted to strangle Crystal with the electrical cord, but when that didn't work, he shot her with his pistol. At some point, James put Brittany and Crystal in the back of their own SUV and drove to Port Bolivar, where he dumped their bodies. While moving quickly, detectives acquired an arrest warrant for James Cosby and headed over to the vigil for Crystal and Brittany that was still taking place. As they arrived, James was still speaking with supporters, some of the news media, and friends and family about the need to build more public support so they could actually find Crystal and Brittany's killer. He was taken into custody, willingly, by police. Down at the station, however, James Cosby was not a very cooperative witness. Detectives said he was not forthcoming with information or answers, he was aggressive at times, and also intelligently evasive.
Oh, so he was all talky-talky when it came to getting all of the support and sympathy, but then when it comes to answering questions about his involvement, then he doesn't have a word to say, huh?
Right. As soon as detectives seem to know a little bit more about what's going on and start to kind of hint at he might have some trouble coming his way, he just clamps down.
Yeah.
Well, detectives were prepared for this sort of response because they knew, from James's rap sheet, that he was a repeat offender. He had recently went to prison for failing to report himself as a sex offender. And his track record of aggravated assaults and sexual assaults told investigators he had been through the system before and knew how to talk with police. Lieutenant Tommy Hansen, who was in the interrogation room that day, told Crime Watch Daily, quote, "I've interviewed several serial killers and child killers. When I sat across from Mr. Cosby that day in that five-hour interview, I would rank him as one of the most cold-blooded people I ever sat eye to eye with," end quote.
Wow. Well, does that explain why he didn't have anything to do with Brittany before, you know, in her childhood, is because he was in and out of prison for sexual assaults and stuff?
Yeah, and it probably also explains why as soon as he moved back into the house, Brittany was like, "I'm getting the heck out of here and we need to get our own place."
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Well, during the interrogation, one of the detectives asked the question, quote, "I'm going to start a sentence. I want you to finish it." James Cosby replied, quote, "Tell me, what is it?" end quote. The detective said, quote, "I did not do this because," end quote. And to that, James Cosby could only say, quote, "I'm not finishing that," end quote. James Cosby remained uncooperative for the next 5 hours of interrogation. In the end, detectives gave him the full idea of the mountain of evidence he was facing and one last chance to confess, to which James remained silent. Investigators charged James with tampering with evidence until they could find further damning proof he was in fact the killer. 1 month after taking James Cosby into custody, authorities were able to locate that missing SUV. It had been towed to a storage lot in Houston after it was left unattended at a local gentleman's club near Port Bolivar. Prosecutor Bill Reed told the Houston Chronicle that the blood evidence in the Kia Sorento showed that, quote, "Crystal's body was on the left side of the cargo area, and Brittany's body was on the right side. The bullet that killed Crystal was found in the cargo area on the left side as well." Investigators kind of think that this bullet may have been trapped in her hair and then fallen out in the cargo area.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I was wondering how that happens.
Yeah. The ballistics analysis proved that this bullet was fired from a .357 handgun, just like the one that James Cosby owned but was missing from the home. That bullet was actually a .38 round. This sort of threw me for a second because I was like, well, how can a .38 be fired from a .357? Well, it's actually a pretty common thing. If you happen to own a .357 handgun, you can use .357 ammo and .38 ammo fired out of the same gun.
Oh, yeah, I knew that.
Oh, well, I didn't. So, are you joking? You didn't.
Of course I didn't know that.
It's like, oh, okay.
We'll have all of our ammo and gun people who message us about all of these things. They'll, I'm sure, be happy to chime in.
Yeah. Well, both the pistol and the blunt object used in the murders were likely discarded at another location and never found. Even without a murder weapon, though, the prosecution felt it was time to move forward with this case.
I mean, their bodies were dumped in Galveston. The easiest option would be just to throw it out into the sea, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that could be like in the Flatland murder case where we hypothesized that the murder weapon was tossed in the water.
Yeah. I mean, there's those big walking piers that just go straight out into the Gulf of Mexico, and you can just walk down there and toss whatever you want.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to find it again.
Well, they certainly didn't find it, wherever it is. But 1 year after the murders, James Cosby was charged with the murder of Brittany Cosby and her girlfriend Crystal Jackson, and the trial was relatively short. The prosecution went meticulously through all the evidence from the Cosby home to the dump site in Port Bolivar and everything that was found in the back of the Kia Sorento. In addition to all of that, An FBI cell phone analyst testified to tracking James Cosby's phone from Houston to Port Bolivar and back to the Ritz, that gentleman's club where the SUV was found.
Wow, so he just literally left evidence left and right.
Yeah, he's making cell phone calls. He's leaving items everywhere at the crime scene to at his house and another place, like another road. He's just leaving a trail of breadcrumbs.
Yeah, there's blood everywhere in his house that he did a terrible job of trying to cover up. He took off the shutters of their house to transport their bodies.
He left some of her mail at the crime scene with her name on it.
I'm so happy, though, because hopefully we're going to see that these things make it easier to prosecute and hopefully get him a very heavy sentence.
Yeah, and you know, cops always say they catch the dumb ones first.
Yeah, and thank God that there are a lot of dummies out there.
Yeah. One of the other star witnesses in court at the trial was actually James's girlfriend at the time. She testified to picking him up from a Whataburger restaurant near the Ritz, and she also pointed out that she and James had often stayed in that area for weekend trips to the coast.
Wow.
So clearly you can see that this is somewhere he was used to traveling to and that he was familiar with.
Yeah.
After everything the prosecution presented, the defense didn't offer up much of an alibi or a counterargument for James. In the closing arguments, James Cosby's defense attorney, Kyle Verrett, said, quote, "The case presented too much doubt to convict their client of capital murder. There are six different puzzles they're trying to put together in this case," end quote. His other attorney, Greg Russell, used his time during closing remarks to point to the lack of a murder weapon or weapons. According to Mr. Russell, everything the prosecution did was, quote, "zero conclusive evidence to prove a capital murder conviction," end quote.
Hard disagree.
Yeah, I'm with you. After the closing arguments were done, the decision fell on the jury to decide the fate of James Cosby. Would it be the death penalty or life without parole? The jury spent over 3 hours in deliberations before they came back with a verdict, finding James Cosby guilty of capital murder in the case of both his daughter, Brittany Cosby, as well as her girlfriend, Crystal Jackson. A few days later, he was sentenced to life without a chance of parole. James Cosby is still appealing his case and refusing to comment until his appeals are resolved. The family of Brittany and Crystal were split on the final sentencing. LaRonda McDonald, Brittany's mother, was hoping for the death penalty, but Crystal Jackson's parents wanted life in prison without chance of parole. Reverend Ivan Jackson told Fox 26 Houston, quote, "Me, my wife, and my church were praying for life without the possibility of parole, because killing him is not going to bring either one of them back," end quote. Crystal's parents have since been awarded full custody of Zaniah. By all accounts, she seems to be doing very well considering the circumstances. She obviously still misses her mother, Crystal, as well as Brittany, but Zaniah visits their grave periodically with her grandparents. Crime Watch Daily also interviewed Zaniah about that fateful morning, and it was really tragic to hear what she remembered. Zaniah recalled Crystal and Brittany putting her in the SUV that morning as they were headed off to take her to school. But then out of nowhere, she said James appeared. He started arguing with Brittany, and then he reached in the car and grabbed the car keys out of the ignition and stormed inside. Brittany followed, and a few moments later, Crystal left the car to go check on Brittany. After Zaniah was left alone in the SUV for some time, she said she wandered into the house. Once inside, Zaniah heard the sound of a loud bang from James's room. This was most likely the gunshot that killed her mother. Eventually, James later came out of his room and told Zaniah he was leaving and not to go into his room.
Detectives think James may have moved the bodies out of his bedroom window next to the carport so Zaniah wouldn't be able to see what was happening.
Even though she was confused at the time and left wondering where Crystal and Brittany had gone, today Zaniah knows the truth. She was in the house that day when both Crystal and Brittany were murdered.
My God, that is so horrible.
Yeah, and like she was at the worst possible age where she remembers it.
She didn't know what was happening, which I guess is good at the time, but as you get a little bit older and you understand, oh, that's what was happening, then that doesn't help. And yeah, she was old enough to remember it for the rest of her life. I mean, I don't even have words to express how absolutely tragic that is.
Yeah. It's rough, man. But one of the remaining questions in this case is still why, though? Why murder your own daughter and her girlfriend? Well, Detective Denny Kitchens of the Galveston County Sheriff's Department thinks it might be a combination of factors. He told Crime Watch Daily, quote, "We think it's jealousy. He just got out of prison that previous October. He's living in grandma's house and he comes home and his daughter's running everything. She had a great job, proud of her first vehicle. You know, she's eating at fancy restaurants and he's at home eating bologna sandwiches. I think it got to be a struggle over power at the house. I think Crystal was just collateral damage." But there's also something else, and that's another item that was found at the crime scene. According to KHOTV News, a copy of the Quran was discovered in James's bedroom. It was lying open to a page which discusses the relationship of homosexuality and sin. Once this particular detail of the crime scene broke to different LGBTQ plus news outlets, it was almost unanimously seen as a clear sign that this was in fact a hate crime. Galveston Sheriff Office Captain Barry Cook told GLAAD reporters, quote, "We don't know that their sexual orientation was a contributing factor to their deaths, but we haven't ruled it out. We also haven't proved it either." That question still remains in the conclusion of this case. Brittany's mother, LaRonda, told KHOU-TV News, "James told me a few times that he did not like the idea of her being gay, but, like I told him, there's nothing we can do about that. That's who she is. We can't change her lifestyle. I don't know if that's what it was." End quote. Reverend Ivan Jackson has visited James in prison a few times to find out the answer to this question for himself. However, Ivan has never received a direct answer from James regarding the true nature of his motives that particular morning. And unfortunately, that's where we have to leave this case.
The fact that they were gay could have been a contributing factor, there's no doubt, or it could have helped ease his guilt or his remorse after the fact of being like, oh, well, what I did wasn't that bad because they were living in sin anyway. So as a way to kind of excuse what he had already done.
Yeah.
Or, of course, it could have been a contributing factor. You know, just one other thing about his daughter he didn't like and that he couldn't control anymore. And obviously, in a lot of these domestic violence or domestic murder situations, it's always about, you know, power and control. What an awful case. And it's just crazy to think that somebody who, that's your child, that's your blood, even if you didn't necessarily raise her, that is still your child. And how you could so violently butcher her and her partner and completely upend Crystal's daughter's life and have her go through all of the trauma that she went through and everybody else in their life, obviously, and this entire community. And then you go out and you're participating in the candlelight vigils for them and you're talking to the media and you're making speeches.
That was the most disgusting part for me.
That is absolutely horrific. Are there videos of him making these speeches before he was arrested?
Yep.
Did you watch them?
Yeah, and it's disgusting. Like, he seems genuine, which makes me even more creeped out that he can pull off being genuinely concerned and feeling good about the direction the case is going, that police are going to find the killer, trying to garner support from everyone.
Ugh, it's like the Chris Watts thing.
Yeah.
All over again, although he did not seem genuine, but it's the same thing. I mean, just going out there and being like, oh, I don't know what happened. Isn't this so horrible? I don't know how you can do that. Even if you're trying to cover your ass, I just don't know how you could physically do that. And that's just, what a horrendous story.
Yeah, and it's so sad too, because Crystal and Brittany really seemed like they were on their way up, you know, that they were on their way to improving their lives and improving Zaniah's life.
Yeah.
They were just about to get their own place and they seemed like they had good jobs.
I know. And they were what, only 24?
24.
Man, that is so, so sad.
Yep.
So, and he's never talked, huh? And he's still going through his appeals. He's never admitted fault.
Right. He's refused every interview opportunity with all news media about the case until his appeals are done.
Hmm. Okay. Well, I mean, I feel like there's whole lot of evidence there. So,
dude, I mean, we've talked about mountains of forensic evidence before, but what did we say? Over 300 pieces of forensic evidence out of his bedroom alone?
I mean, that's like the Mount Everest of forensic mountains.
It's a lot. Oh, also, we mentioned that he wasn't a very good match for that composite that was taken at the ferry dock that night. And, you know, some people who have followed this case have theories that there was another accomplice. And there's also another vehicle that was seen on that security footage from the liquor store as well as the ferry landing that matched each other, that were kind of following the Kia Sorento.
Oh, wow. So maybe he got like an old prison buddy or something. I mean, he was involved, obviously, in some bad stuff if he was in and out of prison. So
yeah, and he may not have even been driving the Kia Sorento. It might have been his accomplice. Because they had different facial hair, markedly different facial hair, and were much shorter than him.
That's interesting. And he doesn't want to bring that person up because then
he's a rat.
It's still, well, it also still looks like he's involved.
Yeah.
So he has to pretend, I don't know anything about this.
Yeah, but there might be somebody else out there who is involved with this.
Wow. That's interesting. Maybe one day we'll get answers, but maybe not too. But thankfully, he's at least in prison, hopefully forever. That's just really, really sad, man.
Yeah. I hope it was an informative episode. And, you know, the one thing that I want to take away from it is the great job that those LGBTQ plus news outlets did on covering this case. We shouldn't, like you said earlier, they shouldn't be the only ones that do a great job at covering this case. It should be all news media. But, you know, we wouldn't have had the amount of detail in this story without those sources to present it to you, the listener. So it's another way that we're bringing these stories to the forefront and to everybody who listens to this show is thanks to those media sites.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Well, I do have a good news story for you. So we will go ahead and switch gears and we will do that next right after this.
Hey, everybody. I just wanted to stop down for just a second and tell you guys about an awesome new deodorant I've been using called Native Deodorant. And the great thing about Native deodorant is that it actually works. And I'm not just saying that. I'm a big guy and I need a powerful deodorant, and Native has definitely worked for me. It's good enough for your workout, if you're a busy dad like I am out there doing yard work, or if you have like a 16-hour day. The other thing that I really like is how this deodorant is made with clean ingredients. So it says right on the label that it is paraben-free and aluminum-free. Some of those aluminum deodorants really irritate me, and I don't get that with this particular deodorant. The nice thing also about Native is that they have over 7,000 five-star reviews. You can check them out on The Today Show, Women's Health, Ellen, as well as Good Morning America. What's also great about Native is that it comes in a wide variety of enticing scents for men and women. Right now, like I said, I'm using the cucumber and mint formula, which I really like, but they also have lavender and rose, coconut and vanilla, as well as eucalyptus and mint. They also offer free returns and exchanges in the US, so if you don't like it, you can send it back. And for 20% off of your first order, visit nativedeodorant.com and use promo code CATTLE during checkout. That's 20% off for your first purchase at nativedeodorant.com. The promo code is CATTLE. All right, now back to the show.
One of the listeners we met in Chicago submitted this story to our Facebook group, and in fact, she's been emailing us a bunch of good news stories, so thank you so much, Lori. This is a really good story. I think you're going to like it. This story was first published on Abilene Reporter News by Timothy Chip back in February, so this did happen a few months ago, but it's still good enough to share, I think.
All right, sounds good.
Well, this comes from Madison Middle School in Abilene, which is about 150 miles west of where we live in Fort Worth. It was nearing the end of the school year, and a teacher at the school named Brady Sloan noticed that some of the kids were getting a little stressed out with tests and projects and deadlines, and she wanted to do something a little special for them. So she decided that she would reward her advanced placement 8th grade art students with a day she called the Flash Bob Flash Mob at school.
Flash Bob Flash Mob.
Yeah, let me see if you can piece it together. Her and dozens of her students took some time off from their classes, donned short curly brown wigs, long-sleeved denim shirts, and jeans, grabbed their paint supplies.
Oh gosh, I already know.
Do you see where we're going
here?
Yeah,
I see it.
And they all dressed up like the great Bob Ross. They went into the auditorium and they had a flash mob painting session. So they projected the joy of painting on the big screen, and they each went along painting one of Bob Ross's landscape masterpieces.
Man, I want to be there so bad right now. I'm envisioning it.
The school was able to purchase all of the canvases and material through donations from donorschoose.org, which is a crowdfunding website where you can go online, you can search through different projects happening in schools around the nation, and you can donate money to them. The amount they raised through donorschoose.org was also matched from the Smarties Candy Company.
Who doesn't like Smarties?
So it was really cute. There are tons of pictures online of these kids dressed up as Bob Ross, and their paintings all turned out really great, and you can see that they are having a lot of fun. Brady Sloan said this was a way to reward the kids, get them to relax through art, and honor Bob Ross. Brady Sloan also told the Abilene Reporter News, quote, "This was just a fun way to incorporate art history, too. He's a part of art history, right? The excitement the students feel when they realize this is an educational experience and a fun experience at the same time is just wonderful to watch." And I gotta say, I would have loved this as a kid.
Oh yeah, I was way into Bob Ross.
Oh yeah, we always talk about our love of Bob Ross, and I think all kids in the 80s and 90s grew up with him, and adults, of course, as well. He was just one of those people who left this legacy behind of being this beautiful soul, and even to this day, I'm so glad that he's still around and he's still being talked about by kids who were our age when we first really started appreciating Bob Ross. So I thought that was just such a wonderful story. And it was, you know, because of the community around them, they were able to have this really special day.
Yeah, I mean, he's right up there with, like, Mr. Rogers, you know.
Absolutely. I would agree with that, yeah.
And who doesn't want to put on a Bob Ross outfit with a bunch of your friends and get that big curly wig on and go paint some paintings?
I know. It sounds like a blast. I want us to do this with our friends.
This is my next birthday party. We're all going to get all of our friends to dress up like Bob Ross, and we're just going to paint.
Well, you know, if I cut my hair short enough, I could just have his hair.
Oh, you do have really curly hair.
If you find that to be sexy.
Oh, gosh. There's probably some really small minority of our listenership that does find that sexy. So be careful what you wish for.
All right. So there you go. There's your good news story. So congrats to Brady Sloan for what looked like a very excellent Flash Bob Flash Mob event. And I hope that they continue to do this in the future. It sounds like a great thing they could do annually.
Well, next up on the show, we're going to move into our after show segments. The first thing we have coming up is a recommendation for you guys. Recently at the Chicago True Crime Podcasting Festival 2019, we had the honor of meeting Robin from The Trail Went Cold. He was wonderful, and he was involved with a live episode recording and I believe a panel as well. And we got to chat with him a little bit because we've all covered one of the same cases.
Yeah, so The Trail Went Cold is a podcast that focuses all on unsolved mysteries and true crime. So these are cases that are obviously some of the most important because they don't have a resolution. Word about them still needs to go out, and more people need to hear about these kinds of cases to hopefully get a resolution. And that's what Robin does. And he does it really, really well. His research is impeccable. He really honors the victims and the victims' families, I believe. And I think that's something that's really important to him and I think is showcased on his podcast. And speaking of which, just like you said, Shay, we did cover one of the same stories on each of our podcasts. That was our episode 47, Missing and Murdered in Lockhart. And it was covered on episode 39 of The Trail Went Cold. And that's the story of the murder of Latricia White and the disappearance of Lee and Chance Wackerhagen. Robin alerted us to the fact that there was recently a blog post that was published, and the writer of the blog post actually worked very closely with Gay, who was Chance's mother. And Gay has a lot of things, kind of new things to say about this case. And a lot of this information has not been shared publicly before. So we would really suggest that you go check out this article so you can read some more in-depth information coming straight from Chance's mother. And that can be found on lostinfoundblogs.com. It's lost and then the letter N, foundblogs.com. And it was published on July 14th, 2019, so just recently. And we also have the links to that blog up on our Twitter and on our Facebook group as well. Thank you so much to Robin for telling us about that and reaching out as soon as he heard that we had put this episode out. He had reached out and talked to us about it. And so that was really, really cool. And again, he's a great guy and it has just such a fantastic podcast that we are really thrilled to be kind of friendly with now.
Yeah. I mean, even being associated with Robin's show is awesome.
Yeah. And so if you're interested, here is the promo for The Trail Went Cold right here.
Hello, everyone. This is Robin Warder, host of the true crime podcast, The Trail Went Cold. If you grew up watching the classic television show Unsolved Mysteries, then this is the podcast for you. Each week, I profile a new unsolved murder or missing persons case and share all the baffling details. Afterward, I provide my own personal analysis and theories about what might have happened. This is a show for true crime buffs who are fascinated by cold cases and love to discuss them and pick them apart in an attempt to figure out the truth. So be sure to check out our podcast to learn about some truly bizarre unsolved mysteries where the trail went cold.
Well, and that leaves us with our last segment of the show, which is where we have to do all of our shout-outs. And of course, this is a regular episode, so we got to hit all of our Texas Rangers. They're a big part of our show. They're producers of the show, so they get mentioned every episode. And that includes Lisa Mann, Stephanie White, Matthew McConnell, Serial Killer Sweets, Kate Williams, Don Maloney, Andrew Margerison, Mel T, and Lisa Layton.
Woo, woo, woo. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you, guys. Yeehaw. Texas Rangers. And after that, we have to do everyone else. That means we need to do small town sheriffs. Those include Ibro Kopic, Janet L. Ward, Nikki Aldridge, Laura Romaine, Christina Miller, Rory Williams, Mickey Inn, Molly Smith, Danny Jordan, Elizabeth Campbell, Angela Walker, Rebecca, and Ashley Parker. Next up, we have our lone guns, and that's going to be Brenda Jernigan, Julie Essen, Michelle McDonald, Dan Clark, Ashley Nutt, Erica Barlin, Nicole Nymella, Melanie Mendoza, Thomas Geimer, Brandy Doyebi, Madison Sweeney, Quinn Hammond, Mary Bobbitt, Marianne Murphy, Aaron Demir, The Strictly Homicide Podcast, Danielle Thompson, Amy McMahon, Laura, Lindsay Wiggins, Geraldine Carmichael, Mary Alice Cafiero, Patricia Wilson, Diacondra Hapsari Subagayo, Stacy Wolf Wegleitner, Karen Burrows, Pam Sullivan, Coral Baish, Allison Lynch, The Dark Poutine Podcast, Allison Moon, Elise Lynch, Amy Derrick, Jenny Cargill, Jeremy Thomas, Sam Marshall, Ann Nunnally, Amanda Newman, Marshall Bingham, Megan Jirai, The Gone Cold Podcast, Claire Jeans, Emily Haish, and Lauren Miller. Thank you guys so much. That was a ton of names. And, you know, we've had a lot more Patreon supporters that have subscribed recently. So thank you guys so much for supporting the show. And we now have Patreon supporters that have almost been supporting the show for an entire year.
That is so crazy to me.
Yeah. And it means so much to us that you guys are subscribing to the show on Patreon and helping support these episodes and, and fund this research and get all this stuff out to you guys. And I hope you're enjoying all the Patreon-only stuff. We got some more stuff planned for you. We might be doing a giveaway this month.
Oh, yeah, we did talk about that. We were thinking of doing maybe a t-shirt giveaway for a couple of the top tiers. We were also thinking about doing some more live videos and stuff like that just for patrons. People seem to enjoy the couple of live videos we put out while we were in Chicago. So we thought that might be something kind of cool for you guys. So if you have any ideas about topics or anything like that, maybe I can do a couple like bone videos.
Yeah.
Because that's all I know. We're probably just talking to each other at this point. Does anybody listen to the very end of this, of the podcast?
Probably just Patreon supporters and hardcore ACNC fans.
It's probably just you and me here.
Yeah.
But anywho, if there is anybody out there, we love you so much. Thank you for support and for continuing to listen. Bye.
And that's the end of our show. So we'll see you guys next week. We got some more stuff planned for the episodes coming up. Hopefully it all pans out and works out. We had to file a FOIA request on a case that we almost had ready to go, but we had to tap the brakes. So that one should be coming down the pike soon. But other than that, we got nothing left. So always remember that crime is bigger in Texas, y'all. Adios.
Bye.